I've been doing MP3s for every lecture.
Okay, I'm just going to stay around there.
Okay, may as well go ahead and get started. First thing is, did anyone not get the writing handout from last week? We are asking that because we've been reading your proposals, and technically, almost all of them were good. Writing-wise, I would say one-third of you know how to write, one-third of you don't know how to write, and there's one-third in the middle. You're writing up, by the way, our comments on your proposals, and what we'll do is we're expecting that we will email each group probably the written Word document using our evaluation form with the with our comments on it. And our evaluation form sort of looks like this, where you'll get comments on each of these. But what we'll also have, and we'll either return a scanned document to you, or basically you can just come around and pick it up. But we're going through and marking up all of the proposals. And some of them have gotten, for example, on the first page, a fair amount of write-up already. So it's not necessarily bad, but as I said, the biggest issues have simply been with your writing.
Can I add by simply saying, one of the items that I made mention of last time I talked was that you need to pay attention to what you think the reader sees. If you just put something down on paper because you know what it is, and the message doesn't get to your reader, you've been totally unsuccessful. Too many of you assume that your reader knows what your anacronyms are about, what your background's about. You probably know the subject upside down and backwards, but it doesn't mean that the reader does. So stop and think and ask yourself the question when you write a section, does the reader get the message I want to have come across? If you think about that, you'll get a big jump on what Frank and I are talking about here. Pay attention to what you think the reader has got in the way of the message. And if you conclude that he may not have, stop, consider yourself a draft, and redo. Okay? Please.
Yes. Just some general comments there. Lots of you used a lot of acronyms, most of which were never explained. Okay, that's bad. A very strange thing, which I couldn't figure out, was most of you in your, for example, even in your executive summary, you would tell us what you're going to do, and then you gave us the background. Proper procedure is to put the background first to explain what the project is about, and then explain what you're going to do based on that background. But as we've communicated to you a number of times, and anyone in here who's co-op with a company probably knows, although NASA and the government might be an exception, that you operate in strange ways. But good communication skills are usually essential to the promotion. And with promotions are raises and all of those other important things, and we want to see you succeed. We're not trying to work you over because we're frustrated English majors. We're trying to work you over because we want you to get promoted. We want you to become corporate leaders. We want you to be basically running these companies. I mean, with some of the English here, if you wrote a document, gave it to a venture capitalist, I'm sorry, but I don't think you'd go over very well.
Let me make another addition. You don't write an engineering report in a style like you write a letter home to mom. There's kind of like a homey aspect to what you write to your mom. There's a factual aspect of what you write an engineering report, if I can come across with a style point here. Okay?
And you'll get comments on all of that in your report, or in our report on your proposal. Now, a reminder, you're coming up with your first oral presentation next week. This, by the way, is the template. This is the School of Engineering template, and I'll put a link. I don't think we put the link on the web page, at least not a working link. Yeah, this is one of them. There's they're really into branding, and this is the term that if you work at a large corporation, you've got to follow all the corporate logos. You know, we've got to follow our fat guy, you know, the surfer. Put that on everything, and I think all the templates are blue and gray. And for the School of Engineering, there's a little School of Engineering down here that pick the proper font for you. And for example, anytime any of the faculty make a presentation and we don't use the official template, we get chewed out. Yes. Brand it. So we'll give you a link to this.
I did omit the cheesy graphic right here, so
yeah.
Find something better than that.
But this is actually going to be, I think, a real fun talk. Dan has been involved over the last year or more on a variety of projects where what you basically have to do is take, and this is a hardware-oriented talk more than software. We're going to have two software-oriented talks coming up later in the semester. But this is basically how do you take the hardware that you have at the end of a senior project and turn it into a commercial product that you can actually sell. Okay? There's a big difference between the output of a senior project. Usually we tend to regard it as a prototype or a demonstration. You know, you're happy if it works. You know, you haven't thought about all of these other issues, and Dan's going to tell us all about them today. So on that note, I'm going to go ahead and let Dan go. So, Dan,
thanks.
The floor is all yours.
All right. So real quick, are you guys kind of with the people in your design groups? Kind of sitting together? No? Yes? Nearby? Okay, because at the end we'll do a little short activity relating to design for manufacturability. Alright, so like I said, I'm Dan Howell, and you're probably like, okay, well, you know, here's a grad student, he just did this last year, like, where's he to come and tell me about design for manufacturability? Well, I did graduate, which is a good thing, I'm very excited about having graduated. And then, here's some of the projects I've worked on in the past, and most of these are in the senior project sort of realm of like, the method of designing, the time scale, the resources, the money. Some things I'll just point out are like my senior project was doing a formula SAE data acquisition unit, which is this guy. This is a non-working model, so I can kind of handle it like this. So I'll talk about that. I'm also doing some research that will ultimately end up being manufactured, so we'll be able to discuss some of the manufacturability issues that we have to deal with that. And I've also worked out in industry for about 18 months or so between two co-ops and a summer assignment. So I've seen that side of the game too. But basically my focus today is going to help you guys get your senior projects to that point that they want them to, where they're functioning and that they're working. And we'll also want to address some of the manufacturing issues, because even though you're only making one or two of these units, you still got to make one or two of these units and you still got to fabricate it. So you still got to address those design for manufacturability issues regardless. So let's start out with the standard kind of format for a talk, and let's ask, okay, what's the definition of what we're going to talk about? So any ideas? What is design for manufacturability?
It's limiting your cost of parts.
Okay. Cutting out costs. Eddie?
Well, it's designing within whatever manufacturing process you intend to use for making your product.
Okay, so we've got costs, we've got manufacturing processes. Anyone else?
It's designed to make it possible to make mass production.
Mass production? Okay. Any more? Well, I did a little Google search, and this is one I felt that included the most things here. So one big key term that I put out front, proactively. So this isn't, okay, it's the last week of the project, and how are we going to put this thing together? It's thinking about how are we going to make it today. Like in this designing and planning phase, how are we going to make it in 3 months when we have to make it? So it's taking that into consideration. Another thing is optimizing all the manufacturing functions. So that includes fabrication, assembly, test, getting the parts, shipping it out, delivery, service and repair. And then it goes back to the things that we talked about here. You know, how do we make it for the best cost, the quality controls that we need to have. There's regulatory compliances that we have to address. And you can read the rest of them there. So there's a lot to go into it. And along with design for manufacturability, they have this term that's called concurrent engineering, which is the task of not only developing the product, but also developing the process at the same time. So it's not just making one at a time. It's going right from the beginning and saying, okay, how are we going to make a million of these? So at this point, another one of those lectures. We're going to go through everything. It's going to be kind of boring. But, you know, I just really kind of want to get out of here. I just want to get one made. I don't really care about design for manufacturability. But, as I said, it doesn't matter if you're making one or a million. You still got to figure out how you're going to make it. So this applies to a senior project. And the thing is that, like, but there is a big question is, am I going to make one or am I going to make a million? And so you really have to know what you're trying to do in the long run here. So there's several issues that we want to take a look at here and what I consider the project scope. So we're obviously not working here with 10,000 people and designing this giant system. We're working with 1 to 2, 3, 4, 5 people. So that's something we have to consider. And, you know, we don't have 30 years of experience. So how are we expected to really, you know, make something that works? Well, that's something we take into consideration when we decide what we're going to make and whether or not it's really feasible to do so. So we also take into account the fact that we have a limited amount of experience, and with that carries some risk. We've got to do some learning. And this isn't our only job here at school. We're not just working on this one project. So we do have other commitments, and that's something we need to take into consideration with our timing and in the development process. There's also things like organizational structure that we have to take into consideration. In some organizations, you have 13 levels of hierarchy and 4 different managers. Here, we're sort of self-managed. You know, we have an elected project leader, and we also have our internal review here in the grading. But we also have a different organizational structure that we have to take into consideration. Another thing to consider with design for manufacturability is there's different types of products out there. Okay, it's easy to consider hardware because, yeah, we're actually making something physical. But software and services also can have design for manufacturability considered as well. And we'll get into that later. Even though you're doing consulting, that doesn't mean that you don't take into consideration some of those things about design for manufacturability. You still have to present a product, like a presentation today, and there's things that have to be taken into account with that. Your customer is also important. Are you making this for one person? Or are you making it for a group, like a research design group? I have a senior project this semester that's helping write some software for my research. And so I am essentially their customer. And so that is something that they have to take into mind. You may also be selling this to a company. Like if you're just developing things that are going to be used in an industrial setting, that's going to change the way you design something versus how if you're selling something to a customer like or a consumer that, you know, wants something nice and flashy. So that's something that to take into consideration, and that's something that I've seen in my own development. Some other things, competition. Are you the only one that has to design this, or are you actually competing against someone else? I mean, that's something you have to take into consideration here when you're making it. And with that in mind, you also have different time frames that you have to deal with. For us, we have a pretty hard deadline. I think it's December 9th. This thing, you guys have the presentations. I think that's the end of class, isn't it?
Yeah, that's our drop dead date. We're an industry, that's the terminology.
So that's the drop dead date that you guys have to have this working. You know, it's kind of the hands off date. But then there's other cases when it's really, who's going to get to market first? So there's no hard deadline. It's really like, okay, can we get this done? How fast can we get it done? And, you know, if we're the first ones there, do we win 90% of the market share? There's also things like a market window. When you're developing microprocessors, you know, there's certain families of microprocessors, and you're designing this product that has certain specifications, but in 6 months, it's not going to matter because they've already moved on to another product line, and you can't even sell your product. So that's something that has to be taken into consideration when you're deciding what you're going to design. There's also things to keep in mind with design for manufacturability in terms of financials. Are you going to build something that requires a $1 billion fabrication facility to make? Or can you get by with something that doesn't take as much? Are you going to contract out that work to have somebody else do it for you? And there's also the concept of opportunity cost. Anybody taking microeconomics? Okay, you guys probably know this term. Basically what this means is I can work on this project or I can work on something else. And so what's going to make me the most money? What's the most likely to succeed? So these are some of the things that come to mind when you're doing this product conceptualization phase. So I kind of broke it down this way to just give an overview of kind of what it is. You know, we're the little guy here doing the senior project, or you might be an entrepreneur starting your own company, and you'll still be that little guy trying to go up against the big guy. And it just goes here to show that you have different sets of concerns depending on what your project scope is. So like for a small design team, you know, you have a few people, maybe a little experience, where like a big company might have a lot of people. And the project that you do, like a data acquisition unit is fairly straightforward to design and can be handled by a few people. But like a giant microprocessor, I worked out at Intel and we had 500 people working on a server microprocessor. And that took a lot of people to do. You have different customers, obviously. For us in senior project, we don't really have much of a competition, even though there is the Philips design competition at the end. So in a sense, you do have a competition that way. You've got to design a better senior project in a sense. But then there's also other markets where you do have competition, and you're trying to establish customer bases and things like that. We mentioned the time frames here, and there's also the financial considerations in the project scope. Here, you know, you could choose a different senior project to work on if you wanted to, but there's relatively small investment. But for like Intel, when they decide to do a product, it's a massive investment in terms of infrastructure and people and their time, and they could be working on other projects at the same instead of the one that they've chosen. So these are all the kind of upfront considerations to take into mind before you even really get into the design for manufacturability issues. So, okay, what's the whole point of design for manufacturability? We had that nice long definition there, but at the end of the day, we need to be able to figure out what the scope of the project is so we know that who we are and what can we do, like what's really manageable and feasible within the time frame that we're working with. So this really sets the stage for how we approach the problem throughout the semester. Okay, so the basic point of DFM, we want to make something that will work. We want something that's safe. We want to make it on time. And in the end, we want to make money or earn the grade. So that means coming in under budget and under time. So this is why we really care about it and why we take it into consideration when we design products. So when do we consider DFM? Okay, it's proactive, but it's also reactive. It's not something you do once. It's something that goes on and on throughout the entire process. And then you get to a point where you have a product redesign, and then you're still considering the manufacturing issues because you've seen what works for you and what doesn't work. So the whole idea with DFM is to mitigate project risks. By addressing it now, it's not going to creep up on us later, and we will have already planned and prepared to handle any issues that come up. So now, the product conceptualization stage is a good point where you want to just kind of step back after you have this great idea and decide, okay, can we really do this? Is it really feasible? I mean, is this just going to be too complicated or too hard to make? And do we have the resources and experience to do it? Like, I don't...
By the way, this is what you should be thinking about right now. This is about where you're at in your projects. You've just done the proposals.
Like, I don't think too many of you are going to be trying to design a, 1 billion transistor microprocessor. You know, we just don't have the experience, we don't have the equipment, and we just don't have the money or time. So, and then the other question you might want to ask is, are we really doing this the best way? Is there a better way to do it? So that's something to think about too. And then another consideration in designing a product is, can we protect ourselves once we make it? There's kind of a concept in engineering that once you design something that's new, other people can copy it for half the cost and half the time. So are you going to design this great thing but then have everybody else come in and take your idea? Is it really going to be worth that effort if that's what's going to happen? So that's something else to keep in mind to decide, is this project really worth going forward with, or is there a better way I could spend my time? So here's an example here. Anybody know who this Wardenclyffe tower is associated with? Okay, what does it do?
He's trying to transmit power to remote, utility customers, basically. So okay. Send power, through the air.
It lights up fluorescent lights real well.
Yeah. So the idea here was that like Eddie said, let's wirelessly transmit power. But then when you start to think about it, okay, is this really a good idea? do we really want to just be walking down the street and, start to feel, our buttons on our suits start to heat up because of the, the power transmitting? And, this is just probably not a good idea. So before he went and dumped a lot of cash into designing this giant structure, probably would have been a good idea to step back and really think about it. So I have another example here. If anybody subscribes to IEEE Spectrum.
By the way, you all should.
It's a good magazine.
Okay. IEEE Spectrum. Really good.
So, and that's something you get with your IEEE membership. So, it's only like $30.
I'm an IEEE member.
$30 a year.
I'm the chapter advisor. There's our chapter president.
So.
A really smart thing. And by the way, there are very good job ads. Some of the articles are just spectacular.
So here's another example of like the FBI virtual case file, and this is in the September issue here. And this was something that the idea was that you have this virtual case file that could be used to track terrorists and criminals and things like that. And so they spent hundreds of millions of dollars to develop this, and they just recently canceled it a couple months ago, I think.
Yeah, they concluded that it was unworkable.
It was unworkable. And so there's
efficient use of your taxpayer money.
So this is an example where it was really just a combination of things, but they had this idea to create this thing, and the September 11th attacks had just occurred, so everybody's scared. They just want something that'll do this, and so everybody's rushing to get this done, and they didn't really stop to think about, okay, what's the real smart way to do this? How are we going to structure the program, the system, and they allowed their emotions to really direct the decision-making process, and it really just ended up being a failure because they didn't really stop to make that reality check at the beginning of the project to determine, okay, is what we're really doing feasible? Are we going about this project the right way? So that's another case. So now I'll kind of step you through the design process of developing a project and considering the design for manufacturability issues at each step. So pretty much anything that you do now is going to have some sort of development tool or design tool. So that might be some software to lay out a circuit board. It might be a software development kit. It might be test equipment. That's also a development tool that you'll need to use, possibly. There's like engine test stands if you're doing Formula SAE. That's something very important to have. And so these are things that you need to take into consideration. Consider each one and determine, okay, well, what risk is inherent to each one of these? Like, how long is it going to take me to learn this software development tool? Do I have to pay for a license? How much is that going to cost? Once I develop this system and I'm going to start shipping software with this, toolkit or some sort of software module, am I going to have to pay for each one of those that goes into every project? And is that going to be... How am I going to integrate that into my software? How am I going to distribute it? Do I have to pay a royalty to use it? And then within the senior project, one thing that's very important to consider is How quickly can we order this software development tool? How quickly can we get this microchip programmer? All these things. And then once I get it, have I used this thing before? Do I know how to use it? These are all things to consider early on in the project, and then immediately address it so you can reach that deadline. So, again, here's an example. This was something that we... So this is just kind of like a lot of... I think there's going to be several microcontroller development projects here. So I just have an example here from one of them that's measuring temperature and then measuring temperature off of a race tire, and they want to store that data locally and then transmit that downstream. So they're probably not going to have a circuit board finished until mid-semester, but they really can't wait until that point to start writing the firmware. That's something that has to be addressed immediately. So the person needs to start learning development tools. They're going to figure out how is this going to be installed on the circuit board. What are the pin connections that are going to be required? It's all these things that ultimately go into that manufacturability stage down the road. So it's really important to get started early with those sort of things and identify the risks and issues involved with that. For one example here, I'll try to use several examples along the way here. This is the data acquisition board that we designed last year. And there's this programmable system on a chip here that is basically a microcontroller and analog array of components that can be programmed to do pretty much anything you want in terms of analog filtering or sampling, A to D conversion. And this is something that was very new to me. So at the beginning of the project, I immediately started learning the software tools. So by the time we had this very complex circuit board design, I already knew how to run the software and could immediately start to program it. And even doing that, this project was very challenging to complete just due to the time frame that we had. So, but if we hadn't started doing that early on, there's no way we would have been able to finish this project.
That's part of your project planning or project management. It's really smart, you know, to have the firmware and the hardware come together and be finished at about the same time. That's the most efficient way to do it. That's what a lot of this project management is all about.
Another consideration we had in this project is you can see that there's very tiny pins here, and we had to decide whether or not we could really solder them together. And that was actually a challenge, was actually getting these things. These are 0.025-inch spacing components. So that these pins are actually narrower than a soldering iron tip. So it's rather challenging to actually get those to solder to the board but not to each other. So that was something that we had to figure out early in the design stage to see if we could actually assemble these. So we got a prototype circuit board out very quickly, and we wanted to test out these manufacturing issues, or test out assembling these components so that we knew that down the road we could actually make something like this, and we didn't need to go to a different design method.
By the way, a problem we have in senior project every semester is with surface mount components and soldering to a printed circuit board. So if you're planning on doing that in your project and you're not sure how, or you don't think your eyesight's good enough to solder them, or whatever, you know, let us know, because there's usually people around that can help.
I had 8 years of soldering experience before I tackled this, so you know, that goes into the experience thing, knowing whether or not you have the skills to be able to do something like that, or if you need to go for something a little bit more simple, like a through-hole component or a wider pitch surface mount part. Okay, so let's see. Where are we? Okay, so we talked about that. And then the other issue is, like, you got to buy these components. And so some questions to ask yourself, can I buy a part to do what I need, or do I need to make it myself? So that might be something where, do I need to design an FPGA to do some sort of addressing scheme, or do they have one that's already made for me? Or is there some sort of software package to handle infrared communication, or is that something I'm going to have to write myself? So that's addressing the system complexity issue, is how deep of the how far do I have to do the development work? Then there's also, like we said, can we assemble the part? Or do I have to have a machine do it for me? For senior projects, we don't really have that option to do a whole lot of machine assembly. A lot of it has to be done by hand. But on the flip side, in a manufacturing process, You want everything to be machined by hand, or to be assembled by a machine, because the cost of labor to have somebody hand solder stuff is very expensive, and that's something that I've encountered with my consulting work. I'm designing some consumer products, and we're finding that for a low margin product, you really have to have everything machine assembled, or else the costs are just going to be too high. Then the other case in my research is, can we buy the parts in a small enough quantity? We want to develop these stimulation bandages with a flexible substrate. But the problem is, in order to buy that flexible substrate material, we have to buy a 10-foot roll. Now, that's not 10 feet linear, that's 10 feet in diameter. And for a research project, you know, that's just not going to fly. You know, we don't have $500,000 to spend on a 10-foot roll of flexible substrate. So we have to be able to work out those issues and be able, okay, thank you. Turn everything else off.
By the way, one thing that often helps, but it's also a danger, is getting engineering samples. That's often a good way to get a small quantity if you just need a couple specialized chips. Lots of times the companies love to help you out with a couple sample products. It's free, but you get what you pay for. The delivery might be 3 weeks after you talk to the person or later, or worse.
Or they might just ignore you. That was one thing that happened with our senior project, and I'll get into that later, is we just got ignored. And so you can do the little web application to sample your parts, but sometimes you have to call up the distributor and just beg them for parts, being like, hey, I've got this senior project. You know, can you help me out here?
You think about it a little bit more. You know, you're working for Case Western Reserve. You don't say a university. And, you know, we're developing a product. The potential market is $500,000 a year. And, you know, that gets their interest. But you can't say who you're working for because it's a confidential product development.
Sometimes you have to make rather large estimations for product success. And then there's other questions like how long have these parts been on the market? One thing that's very important to know is like, have these really been field tested? You know, people just like you and I are designing these things and putting them on the market. Doesn't mean that they work. And that's something that we found in our senior project is they made these parts with all this extra memory. And that sounds great, but hey, you know what? Doesn't quite work well. So that's something to keep in mind. Perhaps you want to go with something that's a little bit more established in the market and has been proven to show that it works. And on the other side of that is, when will this part become obsolete? There's a life cycle for every sort of like integrated circuit or software package. Like Windows 98 starting to get phased out. So, if you're developing something, how long is this going to be a viable product? And then, what if it doesn't work? Okay, and this is the most important thing. If you take anything out of today, what is my backup plan? And you got to put that in. Anything that's risky needs a backup plan. If you're using small parts, what's your backup plan if you can't solder them on there? Are you going to put down extra pads on your circuit board so when you can't put it down, are you going to have something else to put in place? If I can't get the software to work, do I have another option? Is there a brute force method to program it if I can't figure out how to make it work? So these are really important things. And I have a little example from my project here. We had this compact flash card on here. That's real nice. We were able to put a file system on our data acquisition system. And it's real nice, but if you know anything about flash memory, it's that you have to access it in 512 byte increments. So, and most microcontrollers don't have 512 bytes. But lo and behold, this great programmable system on a chip came out with 2K of memory, and that's going to be great because we can do everything we ever wanted to. But it was a new design, and we didn't know if we could get the samples. And in fact, we couldn't get samples until after our senior project had been completed. So that was something that we had to mitigate that risk. So what we did was we put a backup memory on there, and we just did it discreetly here. There we go. So we wanted to make sure that the system would work. So we put down these two extra components here, and I realize the contrast is kind of bad here. But we put down two extra parts here, so when this great new chip didn't work, we'd have a backup plan. And as it turns out, that kind of saved the day because we were able to finish our project by having those extra parts. So, you know, it seems like extra work when you're designing your circuit board and you're like, well, you know, this might just be wasted effort. But at the end of the day, it saved the day for us. So that's something to really, you know, take to heart. There's other things that you put down, like if you're doing some sort of analog signal conditioning and you don't know if you're going to need extra filtering or not, just put down the pads. Like on a circuit board, they're free. So just lay out those extra pads, and if you need to add extra filtering down the road, you can do that. Like our product development cycle is so short in senior project is that you really don't have time to make those mistakes. You really got to leave yourself an out in case things don't go like you planned. Okay, so now product design. This goes into manufacturing here, and this is where we really get into the manufacturability thing here. Here, we're making one, maybe two of these circuit boards, and that's fine. So, you know, we can use the more expensive part if it'll make our life easier. You know, we can pay a little bit more for the hardware if it makes development effort easier. But if we're making a million, we may want to put more effort in up front into the development. There's a term in industry called non-recurring engineering costs. That's the effort that you do in firmware or software or development that once you do it, you've done it once and you don't have to do it again, hopefully. You know, that's something that's value that's built into every single project or every single unit, and you don't have to pay extra to do that, or the cost is very minimal. So that's something to keep in mind, that the trade-off between component cost and development effort. Sometimes it's easier just to buy something off the shelf and use that, even if it's a little more expensive. And then other things, like with your product, are you going to be using things that are consumable that the consumer is going to have to replace? Can you get rid of these things in your design so they don't have to open up your product and change out parts and things like that? So another thing with the product design I like to look for early in the design stage is, what are the natural boundaries between the product? Like in like a data acquisition unit, it's kind of straightforward. You've got software, you've got firmware, and you've got hardware. And so you can kind of break up tasks that way. And then in software, sometimes it's dividable that way too. Like sometimes you need to have a graphical user interface that somebody can design. Sometimes you can break it into a hardware interface. And then other times you have some more in-depth signal processing or calculation that need to be done. So sometimes you can separate your development effort that way. Another question that comes to mind with design for manufacturability is subassemblies and contractors. For some of my consulting projects, we need to have a plastic enclosure that goes around our circuit boards to protect them. These are consumer products. You know, they want something very nice and attractive for their product, and you need to have it environmentally protected. And that's outside of my skill, my experience, so we contracted somebody to manufacture our enclosures for us. And so that's something to keep in mind with this manufacturability is, okay, well, we're going to do this, but you know, how many other people do we need to get involved with the project to do this for us? You know, I could have taken 2 years to figure out how to do it, but it's more cost effective to have somebody else design the enclosure for me. And then also with that, you know, determine how many subassemblies are necessary. You know, you can break down the project to a certain degree and have more people working on it, but that adds additional overhead at the end to get it all integrated together. So that can go into mind with like a computer. Like you could have everything integrated onto one circuit board, or you could have several cards that plug into it. It just, you know, there's separate issues with each one of those. And so then you really have to look at that project management side of things of how will everybody coordinate their efforts and how will you make sure that it all works together at the end of the day. And then the other issue that often comes up in senior project is, what if everybody doesn't pull their own weight, or what if some part of the project gets held up for some reason? And how are you going to work through those issues when they come up? Are you going to have plans in place so if you know, the software just doesn't work and you don't know how to work it out, are you going to send somebody else over to work on that part of the project to make sure it gets done? Sometimes you just miscalculate how much effort's going to be required to do something. And so here's a great example of subassembly. This is a motherboard. I don't know that it. Yeah, it might be a PC motherboard. But you can see there's all these different people, all these different companies develop these different parts. You got people that make capacitors. You got people that make connectors. You got people that make circuit boards. You got people that assemble the circuit boards. You got somebody that makes the SRAM. All these things have to come together in order for the project to work. And as we develop these more sophisticated systems, that's where we have to that system integration becomes a greater challenge. And then you get to the assembly stage, and here's where the manufacturing really starts to become important. Like when you start developing these systems, like how much of each component do you need to keep on hand in order to keep your assembly lines running? And then where are you going to keep all these extra components? And who's going to do the final assembly and packaging? For instance, in my consulting project, we have we have an enclosure, we have a circuit board, and we have other assembly components that have to go into it. And the question is, okay, who's going to assemble everything at the end of the day? And so you have to work with all your different companies to make sure that you have a clear, concise plan as to how that's going to happen. Other things to consider in your manufacturability design is, are you going to make these one at a time, or are you going to try to step up your process to having, if it's a circuit board, you can panelize your circuit board and make 9 of them at a time, or however many. And so you can just, so the scale of the project or the manufacturing is something to keep in mind. And that also, if you start doing multiple designs on an individual sheet, you might have to start adding in test alignment features and things like that in order for the system to get assembled correctly. As you get a larger circuit board, your relative error increases. And then another consideration when you're assembling the thing is, well, do we have the tools to assemble it in-house, or are we going to have to contract this out to somebody else? If you're a consultant, you probably don't have much in the way of assembly tools, so you're probably going to be contracting out most of the assembly. But if you're a big factory and you're making 1 million units, maybe it makes sense to buy a pick-and-place machine to assemble it for you. And then another consideration in your assembly step, like in the case of a microprocessor foundry, is what safety precautions do we have to take, both for the product and for the people developing them. Like I'm sure you've seen the bunny suits inside of a microprocessor foundry. You know, you got to protect the people, but they also have all these different steps to protect the circuits as well. So those are all considerations that have to be taken into account when you're manufacturing. So here's just an example here of where, it was decided to use automated assembly here. You have these very small pin count pack, or very small pins that need to be assembled, and you need them to be very accurately placed. This is an automated process versus a hand assembly process. So, all these kind of considerations have to come into play. Are you going to buy this assembly machine, or are you going to rent out time for another manufacturer? Then product test and calibration comes into mind. When you make one, you can just kind of play around with it and tweak it until it works. But when you're making 100,000 or 1 million, you need to figure out how you're going to test each one of these rather quickly. Or do you actually need to test every one? Can you live with a few field failures out of 1 million? Are you confident in your assembly procedures to know that you can put things together reliably? And when it comes time to testing, do you really want to be sitting here trying to, touch these really tiny pins, or do you want to have special structures set up to do that for, so you can easily hit those contact pads? So on our circuit board, we added features like we have a debugging port on here so that we can easily connect to and make sure to know what's going on inside here. We also have a programming header that's very easy. If you had a machine, you could just tap right onto it and program the part. And then you also have test pads on the board, too. So there's a, I think I got a picture here. Yeah. This is what's called a bed of nails tester. Basically, the idea is you stick your circuit board in here, and then you have the thing that comes, this whole plate comes down, squeezes the circuit board onto these little metal pins here, and you can do all your testing and programming all at once. So it's these kind of structures that you have to plan out early in the design so that you can very quickly manufacture something like this. So let's go back. And then calibration is another issue. Are you going to have something that automatically calibrates each board, or are you going to hand calibrate it? And if so, are you going to use digital calibration or analog calibration, like with a little potentiometer, or are you going to have something digital? That's something that came in, like in one of my co-ops, was developing these data acquisition systems. You got to figure out how you're going to calibrate every unit.
By the way, let me make a comment here on product tests. This is all, the emphasis here is on product and system, but you can be really surprised at times by the components. Okay, I don't know if any of you were aware that about 2 years ago, a Chinese company started producing electrolytic capacitors. This was a case of industrial espionage. Apparently, some person had left a company that was making electrolytic capacitors with an incomplete formula for the electrolyte, the electrolytic component of the capacitor. Okay? They started producing all of these capacitors, which all of the computer manufacturers started buying. Okay? And they functioned at first really, really well. But after about 6 weeks, and this gets into issues of burn-in and stuff, after about 6 weeks, for example, out of 11,000 computer systems that this one company sold, they had 4,000 failures. The customer was the U.S. Navy. You know, not a very good thing, particularly if you're that company, that the capacitors were blowing up in the computers. And you probably saw on that ATX board there, big electrolytic capacitors on switching regulators. Those were the ones blowing up. Lots of companies will do acceptance tests of the components that they get. This even includes resistors, not just capacitors. You don't necessarily, you know, a functional test is great, but you also need to do extended long-term testing if you're really a don't want to be taken by surprise by some of these things with bad components. You know, who would have ever thought of checking your electrolytic capacitors?
For 6 months.
And so that's something that we take into consideration as a senior project. Okay, do we have that time? Not really. But if we were making a million of these long term, that's something we would consider. And so, I mean, that gets into testing here. Like, you know, we make our circuits here, and they work in nice, normal temperatures here. But what if we wanted to have this working in 85 degrees C or down at 0 C? You know, that's something else that has to be considered. Just because, and when you send this out into the in the field, not every customer is going to have the same application, and not every customer is going to be as nice and gentle to the circuit board. There's different expectations here. Like, you know, this is my baby here. But, you know, when this gets shipped out to somebody else, you know, they're just going to, you know, abuse and all that. So that's something to keep in mind. You got to think about all those situations that once it leaves your hands, what is the circuit or the software going to be subjected to? So, and then on the software side, product testing and calibration, okay, well, you've got things like, okay, well, does this run on all platforms? What if I run this on a different computer? There's all these different tests that you can run to make sure that it will run, that it will function properly. And then there's also the concept of regression testing. This applies to firmware and I think software as well, where you basically try to give it as many different input combinations as possible and make sure that it works in every single case. So that can include both static testing, where you give it one set of inputs and see what comes out, or dynamic testing, where you give it a sequence of inputs and see what see if you get the expected output.
By the way, this can sometimes be extremely important. There's a huge discussion right now in the industry about doing regression testing on voting machines, electronic voting machines, to make sure you get the proper output for all combinations of inputs.
So the next topic would be product packaging. Now, this includes both you know, how are we going to put it into some sort of enclosure, and also like how are we going to package it to sell it. So in this case, like here's our data acquisition unit, and so we have things like we have connectors on the outside of the board, and then we have to take those connectors and get them down to the circuit board inside here. And so we have all these cabling concerns, how are we going to do this, and if we're making a million of them, how are we going to make all these cables? Interconnects and connectors are very challenging in the industry, and so that's something to keep in mind. And then things like vibration, how are we going to protect it from vibration, moisture, temperature, things like that. This is going on a race car, and there's certain parts of it that get very hot, so we have to protect it from that. And things like on this compact flash card, we have to have something that's very a very close tolerance fit. And can we do that with just machining this? Maybe. But we don't have the skills to do that, so we added this little rubber grommet here to be able to get that nice tight tolerance. So these are all considerations that you want to start planning on now. Like, even though this might not get fabricated until week 15, that's something you want to consider now is, like, how are we actually going to connect everything to the box? Another thing that's often something you want to keep in mind is if you have a very close tolerance fit, how are you going to get the circuit board inside there? So this is a little simple light controller that I made for eWeek, and let's see, the lighting's kind of bad on here, but you can see here that there's...
Maybe turn it on the room lighting. Oh, that actually helped a little bit.
Did that help? So you see here that we have these connectors that stick out here, and then we also have components on this other edge, and there's almost no spacing in between the edges of the box and the circuit board here. So you have to think of how are you actually going to get the circuit board inside the enclosure here? And what we decided to do is that, okay, these components will stick through the enclosure, but these won't. So like if you had components sticking on both sides, you can't angle it in there. That's something to keep in mind. And maybe you'll need to have an enclosure that's got some compliance so you can actually just kind of force it in there. It just really depends on your application. So this was a case where, we decided that we were only going to have components that stick off the edge of the board on one side, and then on the other three, we don't allow that. So that's something to consider. Like we said, environmental, do we need it environmentally sealed? Is this something that has to appeal to the consumer? Okay. And are we going to sell this to somebody? And do we need this to have a nice flashy packaging to get their attention? Does it have to have the nice blue LEDs on it? Does it need to have nice swirly patterns on the enclosure, something like that? That's where you get into the product marketing issues. And how are you going to manufacture that once you decide that you have this nice, pretty enclosure? Another challenge in one of my consulting projects is we have a wood enclosure that's rather ornate, but the challenge is finding somebody that can actually make those for us. And you wouldn't believe how hard it is to find somebody that'll fabricate wood enclosures for you. So that's something to consider early on in the project, and find somebody that can do that before you set out designing the entire product. And then the other consideration is, how are you actually going to ship this product out? Maybe you have a showroom where you're going to show off all the components, but maybe not. Maybe you have to actually ship this somewhere else for them to be distributed. If you're shipping to like an OEM, maybe you'll use some sort of static protection enclosure where you can just put the raw components in there, and you got some anti-static foam, and this will be good enough. If you're doing like integrated circuits, maybe you have this little chip carrier here that'll protect all your ICs. Or you may need something like a blister packaging for the product that displays it in a way that consumers will find it appealing. If you're doing software, maybe you have a retail box that you sell it from, or you sell it online and you just have them download it directly. So those are other considerations. How are you going to package it? And with software, are you going to put a license on it to protect it from being pirated? Things like that to consider. And then you get to the question of product repair and upgrading. Things break. And it's probably better to know when something breaks than have it break and not know about it. So are you going to have things like built-in self-test in your product to check and make sure that everything's working? One thing on here is, every time this device turns on, I check and make sure there's a compact flash card. I don't want the driver to go drive around the track for an hour to discover, oh, hey, we forgot the card in there. You know, darn, we didn't get any data. That was a waste of an hour. So things like that that indicate when things are working right and when things are not working right are, you know, are important. If you develop a product that's going to be out on the market for 5 or 10 years and be built into some company's infrastructure or their manufacturing, are you going to have it firmware upgradable? Sometimes this is something that companies will do is they'll just get the hardware working and they'll be like, well, we'll figure out the software later. Just get the customer to buy it and just ship it, get it out the door, and we'll upgrade it later. You know, I don't really like that, but that's what sometimes happens. I have a cable box right now that has a 1394 connector on it, and you know, I was like, oh, great, I'll just download the movies right to my laptop. And I read the manual. Yeah, this feature hasn't been implemented yet. So that was kind of annoying. Something to watch out for when you're buying products.
Was that a Panasonic?
Atlanta Scientific?
Oh, Scientific Atlanta.
Yeah, there you go. So something to look out for. The other thing is, like, are you going to have user serviceable parts in here? If you have a fuse in there, are you going to be able to allow them to change that out, or is that going to require a service call? So, you know, with your laptops, there's not much you can do to repair it on your own. You pretty much have to call in the technician, and you know, they're replacing the entire system board, and they ship that board off to a factory where they repair it. So that's not very field upgradable. But sometimes if on your PC, you know, your video card burns out, you could just pull out that card and replace it, and you can go on. So it's things like that to consider in your product as well. like we mentioned before, how long is this product expected to last? PCs are designed today, and believe it or not, they're not designed to work forever. They're designed to work for about 6 years, because that's about the longest they expect a consumer to use it. So that's something to keep in mind. Maybe you don't need to use the highest grade components in your circuit board if you don't expect it to be out for that long. And sometimes that's okay. Sometimes it's okay to design a product that's not 100% the greatest thing. Because if you're saving costs, then maybe that makes sense. And if you're making these products for a long time, are you going to have access to the supplies of them? If you're designing something and you find out that this part's going to be obsolete in 3 years, maybe it makes sense to throw down pads for another component that you can replace it with down the road. So, and then another thing on the business side of things is, like, how long are we going to have to support something after we design it? You know, are we planning to have this thing obsolete after 3 years or 5 years? That goes into your long-term product development roadmaps. So with that in mind, I'll summarize here. I think we got, 15 minutes left or so?
Yeah.
Okay. So basically, we wanted to consider design for manufacturability at every point in the process of designing a product. And it doesn't matter whether you're making one or a million, you still got to put it together. Even though software may not have anything physical that you are assembling, it still applies, and it can also apply to consulting or hardware design as well. And design for manufacturability starts in product conceptualization, and it carries on throughout the entire life of the product, even to obsolescence. One point here is if you consider this product redesign as well. So that's where you take the lessons learned from the manufacturing processes and you find better ways to do things in the future. So it really is just kind of an ongoing process. And then addressing the design DFM issues in the design stage will mitigate risks and allow you to successfully complete your senior project. For example, if we hadn't put down that SRAM chip on here, this board wouldn't have worked, and we wouldn't have done as well on our senior project if we hadn't done that. So now, since hopefully you're sitting with your senior project groups, I think it might be a good idea to think about, just take a couple minutes to talk about it. How are you actually going to build this product at the end of the day, or at the end of the semester? Do we have the skills? Do we have the tools to do it? And what are the challenges that we foresee? Like, is there a development tool that we haven't used before that we're going to have to learn how to use? And what are we going to do when these things don't work out? So I'd suggest talking that over. And I remember from my interim project review last year, Professor Gura asked us questions about that. And fortunately, we had thought about it ahead of time, and we were able to answer his questions. So. I don't know if you want to take time to do that now.
Yeah,
or
let's do it. Anyone need some sheets of paper? Okay. You know, I'm sure you can come up with a state challenge, like you see Microsoft software.
You developed that yourself?
Just
all the explanation on DFM, was that developed by you, or is that in conjunction? Because the process in industry is extremely formalized. My company, for example, had... that's right. The arrangement of things is that it's all focused on lowering costs. Everything, that's what it's zeroed against. But there's two phases to that. One is, do I have the absolute minimum cost of whatever componentry that I'm about? So generally speaking, they have a design team that comes in and looks in on who designed it originally. You know, the idea of more eyes, is there a better way from the viewpoint of minimizing circuit count?
Yes.
Is there a better way of doing it just up front? And the second part, which is extremely formalized, is what's the most inexpensive way of putting that together? Not just the board, but the whole process. And we would bring together a design team that wouldn't include just the original design engineers, but we bring in industrial engineers, anybody who's going to get their hands anywhere near the product and say, okay, if you had to build that, how would you go about doing it? And we had a very pre-canned computer program that kept track of the number and type of fasteners, the amount of labor time per motion. Have you seen that?
Not to the motion level, but yeah.
I mean, you take it to its ad nauseum,
yeah.
And you wring every single penny it costs out of it.
Yeah.
Now, that assumes that you've got the time to do a second design,
right?
Way.
I mean, that's how it works at Intel. They have the first design, and they shoot it out the
first pass.
But then they have these product redesigns and shrinks and all that.
That's the idea.
They bring a whole different team.
That's right. And you're going from what amounts to be just having something operate in the lab by the original engineers to something that now qualifies to having it put together.
And usually you have to bring in another team because there's too much personal investment in the original design.
Oh, absolutely.
So.
And everything, I don't know whether they got it or not, but everything that you've had to say in regards to the application of the product hinges around getting the whole spec right in the first place, which includes the environmental claims that it's going to run into. My wonderful world had to do with aerospace, and temperature and vibration is an absolute killer. You stop at 85°C, I go all the way up to 104°C,
yeah.
And it'll kill you.
Yeah.
So if you don't get it right, and heat sinking, and on and on and on. So very, very formalized process in order to get the whole thing knocked out. And the trouble is, too many times in wringing that cost out, you forget the item that you put up there, and that is the reliability aspect. You can just bring things out and get a minimal cost, but the darn thing will break after a month and a half.
Yeah. And it's hard to take all those things into consideration.
Oh, yeah, but you got to.
Yeah.
But you got to.
And it's hard to mimic things. Yeah, I did focus it more on, like, kind of a student project level.
No, I
know.
A lot of the very soft spots can but will happen in industry. It's dangerous.
Okay, we got like 7 minutes. Wanna?
Yeah, we'll get a couple of them to list their problems.
Sure. Okay.
Okay. All right. Let's get back to in the hole again. Did anyone come up with a problem or issue in their project that's completely different than anything we've talked about today. I mean, you have some real challenge that we didn't even address.
Waterproofing?
That would come under the packaging in the box. Now, when it gets really interesting is when it has to operate 100 feet underwater. And you get into submarine enclosures. And you have to get, because they have actually mil-spec submarine connectors. But if you're going to get underwater, it turns out there's different kinds of enclosures. So it's just damp or real underwater.
Rain.
Oh, that's just what we would call damp. Okay. That can usually be handled with like a NEMA 4 enclosure or something. You know?
How do you get input?
How do you get inputs in?
Connectors.
Well, there are things like that. You need a lot of connectors. You usually want to put the LCD enclosure inside something if it's going to be in a wet location where it might be rained on. Yeah. Oh, that's an interesting packaging. Okay. That's good, but that's packaging. Good thing you need to think about right now. Are you going to go with a serial display then?
With parallels.
Okay, because there are ultra-high-speed serial displays where they run high-speed digital bus. And that's getting very popular now because the number of wires isn't very large. Of course, you have to use your electromagnetic field theory because it's operating, 300, 600 megabit serial bus with a transmission line. Oh, bet you never thought fields would be useful for anything. Okay, now that's an interesting one. We can talk about that some more offline. Anyone else have a really interesting one?
User sanitation? Well, for the asthma inhaler, their valve is going to be directly on the enclosure that's very close to the airflow sensor.
Yeah, so if it's not going to be used, okay. But actually, there's a couple different issues. If it gets used by more than one person, you better have disposable mouthpieces. And that's a real good one. We usually call that the slobber factor. Okay. Any other really interesting ones? Does anyone have one that they think that they can't solve? A really, really high risk one. Water sounded good. Yeah. How many? Is there a project that doesn't have any?
Anybody using new software that they haven't used before?
Yeah.
That's challenging.
Yeah, that's right. Anyone using new hardware or software? We've got one new software.
Circuit board layout tools.
Teach
it, keep
putting
it
up to the zoo.
Yeah.
Yeah, how many people are actually going to lay out printed circuit boards? Or think they might? Okay. How many of you have never laid out a printed circuit board before? Okay. I think one of the good things which we should do more of in the class is if you get in trouble, don't wait until midterm or finals. We can usually find resources around here to help you. Like people who have used the InDesign software before, people who have used the J2E stuff before. Usually, if you just ask around, there's a lot of resources. And we can help you figure out who to ask. Sometimes just the people in class. Like, how many people in here have soldered and made printed circuit boards before? See? Big help. How many people have used J2ME before? Okay. How many people have used the Van de Graaff generator before? Hey, now that's good. I just threw that one in. Okay. But see, in a large class, there's lots of resources, and we have 400 people or 500 people in the department. So, if you get in trouble, that you're looking for ideas, you need help, or if you're like us older types and you can't see those fine leads. I only have 2015 vision, so I can't handle them.
It's the BGAs that are really challenging.
Okay. We'll remember to come to you. I assume you've had some success.
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, there's some tricks, too. I mean, like, if you're making single prototypes, one of the tricks is to put the balls on top of a via. So if it doesn't solder, then you can stick a piece of wire wrap, in there and heat it up with your solder iron and try to, transfer some heat up to the ball.
By the way, that is one of the reasons why we're having the oral presentations in class. Because if you have any problems, identify them in the presentation. Maybe there are some people in the class that can help you. Like I said, you're not competing for grades. I think you're only competing with yourselves. So if you get all A's and B's, actually if you get all A's, I would be very, very happy. But we're off to a rocky start. Okay, Dan, anything else to say?
Any questions or comments? Feedback?
No. Nothing.
Well, thank you for your time. And
okay. We'll be actually the right time. And there's about 10 chocolate chip cookies left.
I think that should be built into the protocol.
Yeah.
Because I have to do that to make sure that the connection's still there. Otherwise, it will kind of jump back out to an initialization mode.
Okay. Well, although the one most interesting thing of all would be if you get
the crazy sales. I don't know what to do if we don't get a Mac back.
If you don't, then it would go to the normal disconnect mode or whatever it's called to reestablish the connection.
But then maybe they stop.
But if they did, then you just jump back, redo it again, and
so we're resetting a command that we just set.
If you rewrite the same register with the same value, it doesn't matter.
I'm worried there's going to be some case where it'll be a problem to send something that you just have. I think there'll be some situation where you need to know.
Well, I don't
what the last one is.
Because even if we're just banging out all the parameters at one time, if there's an error, we just go back and redo it. Because I don't really know of any case where that would be a problem. Because in the data structure of the recorded data, we can always just read back that stuff. We're not writing it from the device to the from the PC to the device. It's only doing that itself. And so at the end, we want to make sure that everything is working right before we send erase data command.
Or identify what's the end gate part.
So we make sure that we got all the data, make sure that it's formatted correctly, erase data from the disadvantage. But even that, we wouldn't necessarily. Does that make sense? Let's see, we're meeting on Wednesday?
Yeah.
I'll try to write up stuff on my end as to how I see it working. So we kind of formalize that communication. And then you can, add or subtract a little or modify it. Because I agree that we need to make sure that, because IRDA communication protocol is not very reliable, so we do have to
this got beyond just the
checkmates. But like the checksum is good because it makes sure that we send stuff correctly on a certain level. And then like if there's some sort of communication protocol, like if I'm reading commands out of my command stack and the number of bytes isn't correct, then that's just like an error. And then I send that command to you and you handle appropriately. I think it'll help if I just write this down and get it more formalized. So we kind of have a good consensus.
That's 23 or anything until January 1. We could save.
So you're still thinking about having a checksum?
No checksum, just...
Alright, so right now the message would... Right now it looks like the message will just be we send our
command via
the data. You send an ACK.
Yeah.
An ACK or the data. Or if we don't get it, we send it. And if you...
We have no desire to know it.
Yeah, if I get it...
If you have something wrong with the data, you have to send an ACK.
Yeah. I'll send an error, hopefully, an ACK. And then we'll have to decide whether
we'll have to have something for repeated access.
Yeah, like a timeout or something.
If we keep getting maxed out, then like if we get like 5 max in a row, then there's something wrong with it. We'll just send a
reporting error to the system.
Probably more than that.
But that's not the protocol. That's the other one.
Well, we can set that as a variable and just do some testing to see what we think is appropriate.
Is there some way on the hardware end to log messages that are getting passed?
For development, yes. For ultimate implementation,
I just want to be able to like compare what we're sending and what it's getting and see if it's pretty much always correct.
Yeah. We can do that with the EEPROM. I'll just log it all to the chip and then we'll read out the chip and see what I recorded.
Okay, awesome.
So we can
we'll just make a log for what we're sending.
Yeah. So we'll log it both ways.
Okay, cool.
We just
blast that. Thank you.
See ya. Thanks, man. Yeah, I got your email. I got to send you module stuff.
Is there a link or is it all of the work?
It's online, but it's kind of hard to find, so I'll figure out.
But they made it just like on this one. That is one that has so many random.
Not this Friday, it's next Friday. Yeah, so we'll set up a meeting time for next week. Don't have a meeting this week.
And those are nice when they happen. Up to no one. Okay.
Okay.
Okay.